This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Republican lawmakers are reflecting on a successful legislative session, while Democratic lawmakers returned from Tallahassee with less to celebrate. Still, there was bipartisan support for the budget and for some pieces of legislation, including a bill to bolster vocational training and, after years of decline, more state funding for the arts. For more, we're joined by two lawmakers from both sides of the aisle. Well, Amber Mariano is a Republican representing House District 36 in Pasco County. This is her second term in office. Amber, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joined by Anna Escamani. She's a Democrat representing House District 47 in Orange County. This is her first term in office. Anna, welcome back to Intersection.
It's great to be here with both of you.
Amber, I want to start with you. One of the bills you sponsored, which made it through, is the Workforce Education Bill. Tell me about that and why it was important for you to support this.
Yes, 7071, I think, was one of the most monumental pieces of legislation to move through the legislature this year. You know, there has been, over the past, decade at least, a stigma attached to vocational and technical training, and there are so many jobs out there that you don't need a college degree for. You just need to have a skill that you can obtain through these workforce programs, and I think that this is something that we need to make sure those students who do not want to go to college or not interested in going to college have the opportunity to have a career that's going to be able to earn them probably higher dollars than a lot of these college degrees will help you earn.
So what does it actually do? Does it put some more money into programs that might be run by colleges but aren't necessarily degree programs, or does it funnel money elsewhere altogether?
We do create an apprenticeship grant program, and I think one of the most significant things that it does in terms of just setting us in the right direction is changing the current task force that was in existence. Was all led in terms of workforce education. It was led by education leaders, which is great. However, they are not going to be as in tune to exactly what jobs we need filled and what jobs we need training for. So we've shifted and created the Talent Development Council that's led by industry leaders as opposed to educational leaders, but also supported by educational leaders, so we can make sure we are creating the education needed for those jobs that we currently have and are anticipating to have.
Well, let me get your thoughts on that, Anna Escamani. Does this seem like a step in the right direction for Florida?
Absolutely. I mean, this bill actually had huge bipartisan support as well, with Rep. Mariano leading the charge. I think that we know that a four-year university degree from your traditional college is not one for everyone. Of course, I want there to be the assurance that if you want to go to a state college, you want to go to university, that is available to you, that you don't face financial burden. And Rep. Mariano and myself have been longtime advocates for bright futures and expanding credit hours and those elements. So I'm a firm believer in not leaving anyone behind on that path, but ensuring that for folks who want to join the workforce immediately, that there's a pathway for apprenticeship and for me to a good union job with good wages where they have benefits and can collectively bargain. That's always, you know, part of my value system as well. But overall, this bill really does take the state in a direction that can give an equal opportunity for folks who wish to go straight to the workforce and have the training and the skills needed to fill in what are going to be some current gaps in employment, but also we know there's going to be some future talent gaps, and talent is today's form of currency, so we have to be able to respond quickly.
Well, let me flip that around then. What about things you need to do to make sure that there are the kind of high-tech, high-paying jobs, especially here in Central Florida, because for the longest time we have been the part of the state where people come to work in the industry supporting the theme parks and attractions. So how do you sort of make sure that things are happening at the top end of the education scale as well?
I love this question. I've been so critical of our service industry and just how that's been a prime economic driver for our state, and it's not sustainable. We have to make sure that we have a quality of life, Matt, that can attract the best companies to this state. We have to pass things like the Competitive Workforce Act, which banned discrimination for being gay. Some of the most successful companies want to come to a state that embraces women's issues, that embraces LGBTQ+ equality, where we have good schools, good roads. That quality of life piece cannot be forgotten. And so, meeting the supply side in the sense of, you know, creating the avenues to get people into these jobs is important, but folks are not going to want to live in Florida, and companies aren't going to want to come to Florida unless we also create this quality of life where everyone has the potential to reach their fullest efficacy.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it sounds like you see eye to eye, at least on this bill, with Representative Amber Mariano. You're a colleague from across the aisle there. But by and large, if you look at this legislative session, how would you say it went from your point of view? Was it kind of a win for yourself or the Democrats in general? Or do you come back from Tallahassee thinking we need to do some things differently?
Yeah, it's for Democrats, and I'm sure Rep. Mariano would agree with me, it was a pretty tough session. We were the loyal opposition on a lot of issues that Representative Mariano and her colleagues supported and passed through, whether it was arming teachers, expanding the creation of a new voucher program, creating restrictions, regulations around the citizen-led petition ballot amendment process, to, of course, the effort of our state to define sanctuary policies and a potentially create a really unfriendly environment for immigrant communities. That these are all issues that, as a Democratic caucus, we really led the charge against and did our best to, try to persuade our Republican colleagues to join us. And there was some overlap on all these issues on the final vote count. But as listeners know, these bills passed along with Amendment 4 implementation bill that for us, we saw it as interference, not implementation. So it was a pretty rough year for Democratic values. I don't think there's a way to sugarcoat that.
Amber Mariano, what do you think this legislative session got right? And obviously, a lot of Republicans are coming back and saying this was a good session for us.
I mean, obviously, we won't agree on this. I think this is one of the best sessions I've ever seen. We got so much accomplished for the state of Florida and for our students especially. We eliminated certificate of need, which is a huge win for healthcare and will help lower the cost of healthcare in this state. I mean, I just think across the board, in every silo, there was a huge win.
I want to add, too, Matt, to the state budget. I think the state budget was an area that found bipartisan support. We fought really hard from our district, alongside Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith over in District 49 for arts and culture funding. And we did, across the aisle, increase arts funding from what was $2.6 million last session to now $21 million, which, believe it or not, has moved Florida in the ranking from 48 out of 50 to 20 out of 50, which I think just speaks to the lack of arts funding across our country. But we're still not at 100% of funding the Division of Cultural Affairs grant program, which would be $62 million. So we still have a way to go in Florida, but that was a mark of success for all of us. We also saw an expansion in water funding, but unfortunately, there was no policy that passed to impact pollution or increase regulation on pollutants. And so I want to come back to session next year, really fighting hard for some actually policy that can protect our state in the long run, not just solve the crisis we have now. Mm-hmm. But again, it was an improvement in the right direction. And then we did secure $500,000 for Pulse here in District 47. Our Pulse Memorial, when the first budget came out, has zero next to it in the House and Senate. And myself, Senator Linda Stewart, Representative Smith, and Representative Holly Rashine helped to make sure that there was some money in the budget for our Pulse Memorial. And so we're going to hopefully come back with $500,000, counting on the governor not to veto it.
And Anna, what do you think was the factor that got you from that $2.6 million to $21 million? Because that's quite a big jump.
It was in large part to the love and support of Floridians across the state. You know, we hosted a town hall in the district focused on arts and culture funding before session began that had 300 people attend and really created this great energy before budget conversations even really started. And then, of course, working across the aisle, you know, I had meetings with the budget chairman, the chairman of the committee that assigns arts and culture funding, so did Representative Smith, and talking to my Republican colleagues who also understand the economic impact and the altruistic desires around arts and culture funding. So it really was a collective impact, and I'm pleased to see the direction that we're going. Mm-hmm. Affordable housing, another issue, Matt, too, where the first budget that came out, there was zero in affordable housing trust funds for any other area but the Panhandle. And we pushed back and said, you can't leave Central Florida, Tampa Bay, you know, out of this conversation, South Florida. And so though the affordable house trust funds are still being swept at around $120 million out of what should be about $330 million, it's better than it was last session where all the funds were swept, and we're moving the right direction again when it comes to having affordable housing dollars.
Mm-hmm. Well, Amber, back to the arts funding question. Has that been a big conversation for your constituents? Are people, or were they worried in previous years about the dearth of arts funding?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge supporter of the arts. I grew up in the arts. I went to an arts school, K-8, and I was always really involved in theater and that type of thing, and it really had a great impact on my life. And I actually personally sponsored an appropriations for $1.5 million for Prodigy Arts program, which helps students after school or homeschooled students have the opportunity to you know, just sit down for a couple hours a week and paint and draw and just have great guidance and a way to channel their energy in a productive way. And I've seen the impact that it has on these kids. And so I've been so supportive of those type of programs and in general. And I think Representative Escamani and Representative Smith did a great job in picking, honestly, they had several issues they worked on, but really honing in on that issue because it is really important to the students and the people in the state here.
Mm-hmm. Affordable housing, it's been a topic of conversation in Central Florida for a long time, especially because of the kinds of jobs we have here in Central Florida. But what about out in Pasco County? Is that something that local lawmakers there and city officials and the like are wrestling with too? And I'm wondering about whether you would want to see more in the Sadowski Fund or there are some other initiatives that folks are looking to push forward there as well.
I think that we made great strides this year in keeping some of those funds in the Sadowski Trust Fund. And I know that my constituents use the SHIP program very often. I know it has a large impact on them. So, of course, you know, I would advocate for more. But we do have a balanced budget at the end of the day. And, you know, you have to manage that as you will. But I think that we definitely made a step in the right direction this year.
Previous sessions, Amber, have been a little bit contentious. It seemed from the outside that this session went fairly smoothly. I mean, whether or not you agree with every policy that made it through, every bill that was passed, things seem to work pretty well. What was your impression kind of comparing this one to the previous session?
I think it depends on what angle you're looking at. We definitely had some very heated and emotional debates on the House floor, and we saw that, and especially in the last couple weeks here. But I do think overall it was a good team effort from, you know, across the aisle. Everyone worked well together, at least from what I saw. But, of course, there were issues that were very important to the majority here in school choice and making sure our students are safe in their schools, and those got very very heated, as well as the Bay Sanctuary City. So, I mean, of course, we're not going to all agree on things, but at the end of the day, I think there was only two no votes on the $91 billion budget that we had. So it does show that at the end of the day, we can come together on the things that matter for Floridians.
Mm-hmm. On the school choice issue, thinking about that new voucher program, where do you come down on that, Amber? Do you think that's a good move? And I'm wondering too if you have any concerns about oversight, because that is something that comes up, a question that is asked as to whether charter schools that are using public money, there's enough kind of scrutiny on some of those schools.
I mean, of course, that's always a concern that comes up, but at the end of the day, I think the parents know best as what's best for their students. I went to a charter school K-8, I went to public high school, traditional public high school, and you know, when I left halfway through my eighth grade year from my charter school to my public school, I went from learning high school material that I learned with high, I know it's high school material, but I went into this public school learning what I had learned in fifth grade at my charter school. So I think that at the end of the day, it's up to the parents to decide what is best for their child, and if they believe that a charter school is best for their child or a private school is best for their child. I just don't think government should be getting involved, and I think we should be helping those parents make that decision if we can financially do that with their taxpayer dollars that they put into the system, making sure their students can get the best education.
Anna Escamani, I know you must have some different ideas on that particular bill.
I do, absolutely. And I really appreciate my you know, my colleagues' perspectives. And I tell folks all the time, I support school choice, but it also means supporting the parents who choose public education. I went to public school in Orange County, K-12. And one of my biggest concerns about this new voucher program was that it directly takes money out of the FEFP, which is a fund that's really supposed to be for traditional public schools. And at the same time, it increases the threshold where we're not talking about, you know, low-income students anymore. We're talking about middle income. And why not invest and improve our public education, our traditional public schools, and make sure that we're paying our teachers better and that we also put the same accountability measures onto our charter and now private schools to receive public dollars? $1,000, as we do with traditional public schools. And I did bring forth several amendments that, from my perspective, were pretty kosher. They weren't aggressive amendments that focused on accountability. And unfortunately, each one was deemed unfriendly by the bill sponsor. But I'm going to do my part to make sure that, you know, if we're going to see this expansion of vouchers, then we got to have the same accountability standards and give traditional public schools the flexibility to be just as creative, which at this point, they don't have the opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm. So now the budget has passed. You're back in your home district. What's next for you, Anaris Kamani?
The work never stops for District 47. So we actually already have scheduled a town hall focused on affordable housing next week. And so looking forward to doing that in the south side of our district. We have been holding back on a lot of constituent meetings these last few weeks to get back to the district. So I have a calendar booked, a meeting with constituents. And then, of course, we're ready to refile a lot of our bills. My priority legislation right now is our 100% renewable energy bill. It never moved this past session. I've been working hard to find a Republican PrimeCo. Let me know, Rep. Mariano, if you're interested, because we want to make sure that our state is moving in the right direction when it comes to energy creation. And so we're going to refile our 100% renewable energy bill to get to that point by 2050. And I'm really excited to refile it and build, build some events around that as well.
Representative Amber Mariano, what are your priorities in the weeks and months ahead?
Definitely want to keep working on some of the bills that I had filed this year that didn't make it through. And it's funny because there's been a bill I've worked on now for 3 years, excess credit hour surcharges, making sure that students aren't getting penalized for, maybe taking an extra semester or two at college. And this bill didn't pass in its entirety, but we did get it into the big higher ed package this year, which was just a huge win. And it's interesting that I'm not having to work on it again next year. So I'm still trying to figure that out, because after the past few years of really trying to fight for this, we got it done. And it shows how persistence in this process pays off. But, you know, I am working on, I think the opioid crisis, something we is huge in this state. And I passed a bill this year that helps with that. And I passed electronic prescribing that will also help with that. But we didn't get that done in the full capacity that I think we should. So I'm going to continue to work on helping combat the opioid crisis and making sure we can prevent any future addiction and really the problem that we have here in this state.
Amber Mariano, representative from House District 36 in Pasco County. We'll have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by Anna Riskamani, Democrat representing House District 47 in Orange County. Thank you as well, Anna.
Always a pleasure.
Still to come, what does it mean to become American? Gabby Buendia is the first in her family to go through the naturalization process. A conversation with her after the break. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. This Sunday, Gabby Buendia will give the valedictorian address at Rollins College. Buendia recently became a US citizen, the first in her family to go through the naturalization process. From the education desk this week, a conversation with Gabby Buendia about navigating the sometimes confusing path to citizenship.
So my family has been here since 1999. We immigrated from the Philippines during the Asian economic crisis of the late 1990s. And my parents came here on work visas. They're both licensed architects in the Philippines, and they both currently work in architecture firms here in Central Florida. And we applied for our green cards after, you know, my parents had been working for a while. And then after you receive your green card, there's a 5-year waiting period, plus some change depending on different circumstances, specific different things that your family might be going through. So we finally became eligible to apply for citizenship last year. And we were very fortunate that my sister was working in an immigration law firm. She's in AmeriCorps, and she was working for a pro bono lawyer that does immigration cases, and they helped us with our case. And I'm actually the first in my family to go through the process because of legal fees and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. My family's kind of staggering the process, and we can't all go through it at once, but I was able to do it first, and I went through the naturalization process last month, and it was really a lot of mixed feelings. Mm-hmm. It was really exciting. on the one hand. On the other hand, it also felt like I've lived here for so long. I feel like I am a citizen, and I feel like there isn't much that changes in the day-to-day life. But when I sit and I think about it, I am really glad to know that I have the security now, that I am a citizen of America, and this is my home, and the people and places around me are my home, and no one can take that away from me. And also how important it is that I can vote now and engage in American democracy in different ways than I had been.
Sitting in the naturalization ceremony, I'm sure your family was there with you as well. It must have been pretty emotional for them too, I imagine.
Yes, I think it means so much more to my parents too. I could tell that they were really, really excited. My mom kept saying, like, you're a citizen, like, you're so American. And like I said, it was kind of funny to me because I always felt American. I don't feel like I'm not American. But my parents kept saying, like, oh, like, we're so glad that you're finally American. And my family, of course, I have a lot of extended family here, a lot of aunts and uncles, and they're not all necessarily citizens yet either. So we're all kind of going through it one by one. Mm-hmm. So it's really great, too, that we also get to stay, or are working to be able to stay all together as a family.
So you have the one sister?
I have two sisters.
Okay.
I have an older sister and a younger sister that was actually born here. So she's also a citizen.
So how did you make the decision that you would be the first to go through the process rather than your parents or your other sister?
I think what my parents, what the process was there was that my parents have their own work visas, right? And we're kind of just going off of them. And then also because I'm about to graduate, there's certain opportunities that are open to citizens only. So I think my family just thought it was a more opportune time to put me through first.
Do you get the sense in conversation with your parents that they have any kind of anxiety about the fact that, you know, up until this point, other than your youngest sister, their kids are not citizens? Does that make them worry at all about you and your future?
I think if they were worried at all, they didn't really show it. Yeah, I don't think I ever, especially as a kid, think that much about the fact that we were immigrants. And it wasn't until I got a little bit older and I started to understand, like, what that meant and what my parents had to go through to get here. That's when I finally started to understand that there might be different, like, how much more monumental it feels to them to have me be a citizen and to have me be able to do the things that I do and go to the school that I go to and have the achievements that I have. And I think that, you know, even though I don't really like being the center of attention, and it's a really overwhelming time for me with all of this, it's, to me, worth it to know that it means so much to my parents, and that as I learn more and more about their story and what brought them here and what all the struggles and what they had to sacrifice to get here and how things were uncomfortable for them sometimes, I'm really grateful that they did bring us here and did recognize the opportunities that would be available to us here.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Gabby Buendia. She is giving the valedictorian address at graduation at Rollins College. So, Gabby, were these conversations that you had with your parents among your family growing up, like, tell me the origin story, tell me about how we came here, or is this something that's not that easy for them to talk about?
Yeah, these stories kind of come out when I don't really expect them. I, again, can't imagine how difficult it is or for my parents to retell these stories or not. But I think as I get older, I learn a little bit more each time my parents, and they'll tell me like the same stories over and over again, but they'll add a little more every time they tell it. And like as I've gotten older, I've understood a lot more, and it's still something that I am trying to learn more about, like the politics and policies behind it too, and just my parents' personal story.
So now you're a citizen. Who's next? Is it going to be one of your parents, or will it be your older sister, do you think?
I think it's probably my older sister next. She already has sent in her application. Our circumstances are a little bit different. So I think hers got delayed, but she has put in her application, and then my parents will be next, and then we'll all be citizens, hopefully soon.
So what's the process been like? Is it because I think for a lot of people, you know, it's quite daunting filling in the paperwork, learning what you have to do, you know, engaging the services of an immigration lawyer sometimes. Like, what's that process been like for you? Was it fairly straightforward, or did you find out things about the process that you didn't realize would be an issue as you kind of went through it?
It's really long and it's really confusing, and especially since I was just a child or a teenager when I was going through a lot of it. I remember doing things to advance, like, the application and the citizenship status, but I didn't really know exactly. I couldn't draw out the path to citizenship myself, even though I've been through it. I remember visiting, like, Washington, D.C. to go to the embassy, or, like, taking trips to Miami to go to the embassy and to do certain things, but it was just a lot of different appointments and, yeah, paperwork to go through, and definitely not something that I would understand as a teenager. I recognize that my family is extremely privileged to have been able to maintain their status, and that my parents have kept their jobs. At least one of them have always had a job, so we've always had one. One of my parents have always had a work visa. And I know that things are unexpected. And like my mom was, she lost employment during the recession. And we were very fortunate that my dad kept his work, too, because then what would have happened if I had two parents who were unemployed and couldn't reapply for work visas? And I don't want to say it's, you know, completely chance. I know my parents worked really hard, but also at the same time, like, not everybody is as privileged as us to be able to keep status throughout the entire process. If both my parents had lost their jobs during the recession, I don't know what would have happened to the to our progress towards becoming a citizen. And I do feel really fortunate, and that's why now that I am a citizen and I do have the security of being able to stay here, I really want to learn more about the process and what somebody like me in my position can do to advocate for other people who have the same goals and have the same hopes for their family coming here to America.
Do you think there are some things that you can see, say, right now would make it a lot easier to go through this process?
I think that just general literacy on the process. Again, it's like a really long, there's lots of paperwork and things like that. And English isn't everybody's first language.
Sure.
And I know even growing up, like applying to colleges and stuff, even though my parents went to college in the Philippines, just trying to fill out the FAFSA or things like that, it's really difficult for my parents to do with English not as their first language. And so the same thing would go for the citizenship process, I think. Having better access to understanding what exactly it says and making sure that it the language on it is accessible and the kind of pathway to it is laid out better for people.
Tell me a little bit about what you've been studying at Rollins and what you hope to do on graduation.
Yes, so I am studying environmental studies at Rollins with a minor in sexuality, women, and gender studies. And I hope to, after graduation, go into either nonprofit or local government work. But I do hope to go back to graduate school eventually. So I'm hoping to try a couple different things before I do that. But I've had a really great time at Rollins with those two areas of studies. I'm really glad that the curriculum at Rollins is so broad and allows for interdisciplinary work like that. And I was just, I just gave a thesis presentation about the impact of mothers on environmental activism. And I felt like I had a really fun time talking and studying about my two interests. And I was glad that they were able to come together so well and that faculty were so supportive.
Was your mother a big influence on your interest in environmental activism?
It's kind of interesting. I didn't really get into environmentalism or consider myself an environmentalist until college. But now that I do, I can definitely see like the connections that my parents have to the environment. And I know that they care about it. And they are excited about my work and what I hope or want to do for the environment.
With two parents as architects, I wonder if there was any pressure on you or your siblings to go into architecture as well.
I took architecture classes in high school, and they enjoy their job, and they liked that I was showing interest, but also at the same time, they thought there would be a little more job security elsewhere.
So what are you going to be telling your fellow students in the valedictorian address?
Well, without spoiling too much, hopefully, the speech is just really about encouragement. I really wanted to emphasize everything that we had been through as a class rather than my own specific experience. And I really wanted to make sure that everybody felt like they heard some part of themselves within the speech, and that it was also a speech that would be fun and interesting to listen to during the ceremony.
You were saying earlier that you don't really like being in the spotlight. You don't like being the center of attention. So are you a bit nervous about getting up there and talking to your classmates and others?
Yeah, I'm pretty nervous. It's like my shower thoughts. I'm like thinking about getting up and giving the speech. But I just have to remember people keep telling me like this speech was chosen for a reason. And this is the speech that the faculty members think people want to hear. And it's still really nerve-wracking, but I have to be I can't complain. I have to be excited about my opportunities. I'm really glad and feel really blessed to have that opportunity.
Well, Gabby Buendia will be giving the valedictorian address at graduation at Rollins College. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, is Central Florida's startup community the key to our economic future? Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Steve Case, the former CEO of America Online, is on a mission to foster entrepreneurial talent across the country in places outside of Silicon Valley. Last week, Case brought his Rise of the Rest bus tour to Florida, stopping in Orlando, Melbourne, Tampa, and Miami. Case also hosted a startup pitch contest with $100,000 in seed money as an incentive. The winner in Orlando was medical technology startup Air Health. Stacey Ruth is the co-founder and CEO of Air Health. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joined by Donna McKenzie, the Executive Director of Starter Studio. Thank you as well, Donna.
Thank you.
I want to start with you, Stacey, because your company just recently was awarded $100,000 in seed money from Steve Case. Congratulations, first of all. I understand there are about 150 companies that put in for that, so a lot of competition there.
There was a lot of competition, and I'm still smiling from ear to ear.
Did you have an inkling during the pitch that your pitch was going well and you thought you might be in with a chance?
I hoped I had a chance. I spent a lot of time in preparation. It did feel pretty good there on the stage. A lot of energy coming from, I think, over 500 people in the audience. So, yes, you could feel the buzz.
Mm-hmm. Donna McKenzie, this was kind of a big deal for the startup community in Orlando as well, right? Because it wasn't just Stacey's company that got some attention from Steve Case. A lot of companies were able to sort of have a little bit of time with him and chat about their ideas. So having this kind of attention on the startup community here must be a big deal.
It was such an incredibly big deal for the community as a whole. The companies that made it to the 8 finalists to pitch was huge. But also just the bus ride, him going to other places and showing, you know, what, and just showing others and even ourselves, because we don't always know what all's going on in our community. So it just shined a big spotlight on our community. It showed all the things that we're doing well and good, but it also showed things that we need to work on as well, which I think is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And hopefully one of the outcomes of this will be more investment in our community, because it's, you know, as Steve pointed out, it's lacking here in Florida and it's lacking here in Central Florida.
Why is that?
Well, I think the money just tends to gravitate to the coast. So Silicon Valley, New York, and frankly, that's why he started this Rise of the Rest. And he focuses on the rest of the country and the talent. There's talent here. There's, you know, we have great universities. We have just incredibly competent and talented people. And it's just people who've made money here, they've made it in real estate in one form or another. We have not had that great big exit like they've had in Austin or Silicon Valley, where it creates a lot of millionaires and billionaires that will go out and reinvest and start companies. We've had some exits, but not to the degree that it would just really change the landscape of investment. So hopefully Air Health will be one of those first to change the landscape.
And Stacey, for those who aren't so familiar with what Air Health is, what's your elevator pitch?
So we are helping 29 million wheezy kids. These are kids with asthma or pre-asthma with their respiratory care. And we do that with a connected portable nebulizer.
Now, what exactly does that mean for the layperson?
So for the layperson. So when you have a respiratory condition, and in particular, we start with focusing on children's respiratory conditions, you need a way to deliver medication directly to your lung. The lung is where the inflammation is, and that's where you need to target your therapy. So there have been nebulizers for many, many years, most of them large, about the size of a medium pizza box. They're loud. They're not very easy for a child to use. And what Air Health is bringing to market is a smaller than a deck of cards, handheld nebulizer that allows a child to also look at an accompanying mobile app in order so that the parents and caregivers and even their doctors can see that they're getting their drug delivered correctly.
So they have to be looking at a smartphone at the same time?
They don't have to be. It'll be recording the data. Mm-hmm. Right now we have the device itself that's been cleared through the FDA, which is a big hurdle for a medical device company. And our mobile application is under development. And happy to say that we are researching and putting a bid process out right now to have that mobile app built here locally.
And what about the hardware? What about the nebulizer itself? Where is that going to be made?
So it's a U.S.-based product. So all of our components are U.S.-based. It's going to be manufactured here in the U.S. We're just finalizing those contract manufacturing relationships. Born in the USA, if you will.
What does $100,000 then mean to your company? Like, how big of a deal is that, and what are you going to be putting it towards?
So it's a really big deal. We're having some success here locally with raising capital. This will be supplementing. The $100,000 will be used to really put the nebulizer on the market. So it's more about commercialization. Mm-hmm. We're in a very good place with the product itself being completed, manufacturing ready, cleared by the FDA. So those costs are behind us. And what's ahead is getting this into the hands of children.
So Donna made the comment about the fact that there's not a big enough pool of money to help entrepreneurs here in Central Florida. What's your experience been up till now in trying to raise capital to get your ideas off the ground?
So as I mentioned, we've had quite a bit of success, early success. Mm-hmm. We are raising what is considered to be a bit more money, I think, than the normal startup here in this area. We have stayed local. We have found, because it's a medical product, we believe there was a bit of pent-up demand with some medical professionals here locally that have come on board, both as investors and advisors to the company. So it's a bit non-traditional in size, a bit non-traditional in the type of investor. Donna mentioned real estate. Well, these are guys that want to do something more, you know, more in line with what they've chosen to have as their profession.
How do you see, Donna McKenzie, the startup community, whether it's Air Health, whether it's other companies that you're working with, changing the economy in Central Florida? Because, you know, there is obviously a lot of jobs here in Central Florida are based on the service economy, theme park workers and the like. And there's kind of anxiety about how do we make sure that there's more at the top end so that there's better paying jobs, the standard of living raises for everyone. How do you see the entrepreneurial community sort of fitting into that puzzle?
Yeah, that's actually one of the reasons that I'm so excited about what we do at Starter Studio. It's the tourist economy has been really good to us, in my opinion. It gave us a really great airport and other things. But the jobs that they create for the most part are, you know, minimum wage jobs or maybe just above that. And tech jobs, they're going to pay way more than a living wage, at least, in a lot of cases, a lot more than that. And hopefully snow some good exits and we'll create a lot of millionaires and even billionaires as a result, which does change the economy. And I feel like that if we don't focus on creating these types of jobs and focus on creating these types of companies in our community, there are other regions that are, and we will get left behind. And we will always be trying to play catch up if we don't be proactive about investing in these companies, both in terms of investing dollars, but also as Starter Studio and other people in the community, all the mentors invest their resources, their knowledge into these companies to help them grow as well.
And I guess we should point out too that, I mean, if you think about the theme park economy, there are high tech jobs there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, especially
Oh, yeah.
Now they're sort of moving into more VR and that kind of thing. But yes, you do also need a lot of people to keep the turnstiles ticking over and everything like that.
Exactly.
So what are you most excited about? Like, what sort of companies are you seeing coming through, and what sort of areas do you think there could be more investment in here in Central Florida? Like, where could this area get an edge on the competition?
Yeah, that's a great question. We do think about that a lot in terms of what verticals should we be really concentrating on that both helps our local economy and takes advantage of the talent that we have here. And there are some very obvious ones that bubble up, but I think that we have some great companies. There, Educate, that was in Rise of the Rest competition with Stacy. There's just so many. So they were in fintech, which is one that's a really dynamic and growing vertical.
So what sort of things does Starter Studio do to try and keep that ecosystem bubbling along?
Yeah. So what we're really focused on is education. So, and we do that through lots of different programs, workshops, lunch talks, founders talks, where we have founders like Stacy come in and talk about their journeys and share how they got to where they are and every step of the way. We also have two accelerator programs. One is an ideation accelerator where you can literally come in with an idea, explore lean business model canvas, and you know, figure out if you got a product market fit, and hopefully get to an MVP if you do. And then we have a seed accelerator program, which is companies that are into commercialization of their product, maybe with some revenue, sometimes not, but really help them gain traction with their customers and also get ready for venture and angel funding. So that's really the focus. So we're really focused on tech-enabled companies that we believe venture capital will eventually be attracted to investing in.
So, Stacey Ruth, what else does a company like Air Health need to be sustainable? Because it's not just about one company doing one thing in a vacuum, right? You need other things happening around you to be a success.
Yes. Yeah, so you do need an ecosystem. I know that word is a bit overplayed, but it's true. The ecosystem here, we have strengths. We have areas that could be improved. I had the good fortune of working as an executive for a Fortune 500 in health tech, and I had the opportunity to live in some of these big cities. So I've seen what a city like Boston can do when you look at surrounding the entrepreneur, right, or groups of entrepreneurs with what they need from incubation, acceleration, even when you hit the growth phase, the first stage growth, the second stage growth. And I think that even though this community has started with more, we'll call it the seed level, and really trying to create that seed environment, the next important thing is probably for us to get a national level accelerator, and I use accelerator as the term pretty loosely, but a group that has national notoriety that can take a few of these companies and showcase them. I like the Donna's example of fintech. You know, if we, because we have some traction going there, mm-hmm. you know, is this an opportunity for a large national accelerator to put together a group of four or five companies and showcase them around the U.S., around the world? So it's carrying on with what Rise and Revolution and Steve Case have started. For Air Health, it's very important that we find local talent here that from an engineering perspective, from mm-hmm. a med device perspective, and people who really understand how to generate opportunity in the healthcare environment. These are specialties that you don't always find spread out. So my job is to attract the right talent for Air Health. I'm working on that quite heavily right now. And with 20 years in the market, selling and then running businesses in this space, there's a large bench out there that we will do our very best to recruit into Central Florida.
How do you do that? Because I'm sure it's a little more complicated than saying, or a little more sophisticated than saying, hey, we have you know, great theme parks here and you can go to the beach. I mean, there's got to be a little more than that to make people want to come here and stick around, right?
Yeah. So what you do is you find a specialty. And I had the opportunity to run a business here. That's what brought me to Central Florida. It was an acquisition by the large company. And with that, we had the largest concentration of a particular type of biomedical engineer that existed anywhere in the world. And so the business had to be here. So when you build talent, photonics is a good example of that. The autonomous driving industry is a good example of that here locally. When you build pockets of excellence around a certain type of discipline, the people will come to you. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping to really kick that off for Air Health and make this more of an attraction for medical device engineering.
Stacey, Ruth, what would your advice be to somebody who is working to get a company or an idea off the ground?
So Donna mentioned a business model canvas, and I, some people are process people. I happen to be one of those. And even though I had a lot of experience and a lot of experience in this market, I still practiced the discipline of ensuring that we had a product market fit prior to going out and seeking investment, prior to going out and attempting to pitch. So my advice would be sure there's a business there. You're not testing your idea by pitching it. You're really bringing a pitch that has a validated business, and I'll say business model, but a way that you can translate what you're selling into making money. And with that money comes an impact on people or the world. So that would be my advice.
Well, Stacey Ruth is the co-founder and CEO of Air Health. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joined by Donna McKenzie. She is the executive director of Stardust Studio. Thank you as well, Donna.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. We're in the last stretch of our spring silent drive. With your help, we can raise the money we need to keep this station strong through the summer. Make a contribution at wmfe.org/intersection or by calling 1-800-785-2020. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.